Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is, I've got good news and bad news. Good news is for you, the bad news is for me. This is the end of the easy topics. And hereafter, we're going to be looking at some more controversial and challenging subjects. So I'm going to, for a moment, pretend that this IRB is a democracy, and I'm going to let you vote. So I'm passing these out now. It's a list of potential topics that I've been given by Dr. Rhodes and Dr. Zuccarelli. And I'd like you to designate 1, 2, and 3, what you think would be the most interesting or appropriate. Because it's not wholly a democracy, because I'm not necessarily going to follow it, but I'd at least like to get some idea of what you think is important. And over the next few months, we'll try to discuss some of these. And I'm sure there are other topics. That's why I've put in a couple blank lines for you to give me other ideas of what we could do. And don't let me forget to collect these before I leave. So today we want to talk about consent. And over the last two sessions, and we've talked about the history of research ethics and the rules and guidelines that we have to follow, consent has cropped up again and again and again. It's really the primary issue. And I hope that we've covered some of the idea of where the basis of consent comes from. And whether it's philosophical, religious, legal, whatever, we generally think of consent in relation to patient autonomy, on patient rights. And yeah, that's important, but I would really prefer to shift the responsibility to the investigator's responsibility or obligation. Whenever I hear about patient rights, I think of physician responsibility. So in relation to research, I think the importance is the same. So what are the functions of informed consent in research? I'm just going to briefly mention that to promote individual autonomy, as I've just alluded to encourage rational decision-making for the subject to see what are the potential risks and benefits and does it fit with my values to be included in this study and so on. To avoid fraud and duress, we want to keep an eye on the investigators. To involve the public. This is a transparent process so that we should be able to, willing and able to share with the public what's our foundation for what it is we're trying to do. To encourage the self-scrutiny of investigators. I think when an investigator sits down and tries to put together a consent document and put together a protocol so that it's understandable, that really forces him or her to look at the ethical issues as well as the science. Then to reduce liability, of course. But consent is not all that straightforward. In this next bullet, I'm going to just briefly mention now and then come back to it at the end, because I think this is where we should spend our time. The issue of consent raises some problems for the IRB, because valid consent is a process of communication. It's not a piece of paper. And you spend almost all of your time looking at the consent document. And that's critically important, and that's what you have to deal with. I mean, you're not sitting there when the consent discussion is taking place. But I learned at a marriage seminar, 35 years ago, that communication is not what's said, it's what's heard. And so the investigator is saying in the consent document, this is what's important. But what is the subject or the potential subject hearing? And you can really only, from your seats here, you can really only infer what's going to happen because you can't sit there and listen to the conversation. But what does become important for you, and I think we should spend some time talking about, is who does the consent process? Is it the principal investigator? Is it somebody that they designate, whether it's the coordinator for the trial and so on. And so let's talk about that in a few minutes. The elements of valid consent, and notice I use the term valid consent here instead of informed consent. Informed consent really is a legal construction. Valid consent is an ethics perspective of what is necessary. And there are three components, and you know these already, but I'm just going to briefly mention. The consenter must be competent. That is, they must understand there's a choice to be made. They must be be able to comprehend what the issues are, and they must be able to apply their own values in reasoning about whether or not to make a decision to join in the study. I might just mention, by the by, that there's a philosopher named James Drain who's done some publication on the issue of competence for treatment and for research. And not everybody agrees with his assessment, but I happen to like it. He says there's really a spectrum of competence. And for medical treatment, it goes from very low to very high. You don't need a lot of discussion to draw blood from somebody. You don't have the patient sign a consent form to have blood drawn. But they do need to sign a consent form for cardiac surgery. And then somewhere in between, do they need to sign consent for having a feeding tube put in, for a nasogastric tube? We often put them in without consent, and it really has some long-term implications. So I personally think that we should put that through the consent process. But in the medical treatment realm, there's a range from minimal competence up to the patient really needs to be very competent to be able to understand the risks of major surgery. But then when you take the next step up to research that might benefit the subject, then there's an even higher level of competence required, because they have to be able to understand what's going on and be able to understand what is the original surgery and what is the additional risk of enrolling in this consent. And then if the research is non-beneficial, you have to raise the level even higher. The person has to really understand that they are being altruistic, that they are entering this study out of the goodness of their heart, because they're not going to get anything from it. So, spectrum of sliding scale of consent. Second element of valid consent is the consenter must be given adequate and understandable information. And this is what you spend most of your time on. We don't need to spend a lot of time on it here. But the elements include the name of the principal investigator, the sponsor, the purpose of what is going on, the design of the study, the procedures that they will undergo, the risks and burdens. And we often look at the risks, but sometimes we neglect the burdens. How much time is it going to involve? Is it going to be any expense to the subject? Any discomforts and so on? And sometimes there are special sections, risks for women, rarely the same for men. The rights of the subject, the right to that it's voluntary, they cannot be coerced or pressured into it, that there are alternatives, they don't have to do this, they can still get the treatment without being in the research project, the right to withdraw, the right of confidentiality. And one that's becoming increasingly important is about biologic specimens. What is going to happen if a blood sample is drawn, part of it's used and part of it's frozen, and then 10 years later, somebody says, oh, we've got all this blood in the freezer, and people with these characteristics, and it would be helpful to our current project to be able to investigate that. They need to know about that if that's a potential. The availability of treatment for or compensation for injury. This is a current hot topic in research facilities, and there's not total agreement on what is the obligation, what is the responsibility of the institution, of the sponsor, of the PI, and so on. And that may be something that's worthy of our discussion. And of course, who they should contact if they have questions. Then the third element, competence, adequate information, and the consenter must not be coerced. Now, this is one of my own soapboxes, but I really think it's important to try our best to avoid the therapeutic misconception. It's so common that a physician is sitting in an office with a patient with hepatitis, and he or she happens to be running a research study on a new interferon substitute or whatever, and so asks the patient if they would like to enroll, doctor and patient. But as soon as there's the discussion of research, the relationship changes to investigator and subject. And I think it's so important in the documents that the subjects or potential subjects are going to read is that we insist that we talk about investigators and subjects rather than patients and physicians, because it's so easy for the patient becoming a subject to think that this is part of their treatment. The issue is a proxy consent for children for permanently incapacitated adults. I mean, it's really difficult. It should be difficult to do research on patients with advanced dementia or in a persistent vegetative state or after a serious head injury. We have to protect those vulnerable individuals. Or for temporarily incapacitated patients, somebody who was healthy and is suddenly unconscious from a motor vehicle accident, trying to decide if a blood substitute would help. The person is incapacitated, cannot give consent right then. Is it all right to proceed with research and get what's called deferred consent later on? If we're going to talk about deferred consent, then do we need to also include community consent? For instance, I can't remember if it was this group or another group that I was talking with recently about my involvement with the polyheme study a few years ago when Northfield Labs wanted to use this oxygen-carrying substance, hemoglobin-based substance, polyheme, for somebody with hypovolemic shock, hemorrhagic shock. People were not able to participate in consent process. So part of the protocol was, well, you need to announce this to the community that at this hospital we're going to be doing this and let everybody know and give them the option of opting out. So community consent can become very important in these situations. So let's go back and talk for a few minutes about, and I want to hear from you because I don't have a good answer on this, on who should do the consent conversation. Just as an example, a few years ago, in an outpatient setting, I was filling out some kind of questionnaire and mentioned that my father had died of pancreatic cancer. And so not long after that, from somebody within that department sent me a letter of inquiry wanting to know if I would be willing to participate in a research study, just giving a blood sample. They were looking for some marker of potential for pancreatic cancer. And so I went in to discuss it and didn't discuss it with the PI, but with the nurse coordinator who was really running the project. Now, was that adequate? Or should I have had access to the PI? I think there are pros and cons both ways, and I'd like to hear from you folks. So just for the tape, I just might mention that in-house, there's a quasi-rule that if it's therapeutic research, that the person doing the consent discussion should be able to prescribe that. So it should be one of the investigators. So they can answer all the questions. But in some cases, actually, that discussion is being done by a nurse coordinator.
Perception, I think, is a very important thing, because what I may be telling them, they may not necessarily be hearing. And even if I ask them if they have any questions, say no, but they have questions, and they'll bring them up with the nurse practitioner more so than with me. So I usually have them go back in and talk about things again, and then get the consent.
So they get both.
Yeah.
And like that summary.
I'm a little unclear. Do we have a defendable definition of coercion?
Definition of coercion. I envision it at the end of a spectrum, from education to persuasion to manipulation to coercion. And as a physician, I think it's perfectly fine to educate patients and even to persuade. If I'm convinced that for this patient option A is better than option B, I'm going to try to sell it to them, leaving them the option of saying, no, I don't want A, I'd rather have B. Okay. Manipulation, in my mind, is overemphasizing the benefits and underemphasizing the risks. Whereas coercion really is a more forceful a threat to, well, I won't take care of you anymore unless you take part of my study. I mean, that's really an end. So what we're concerned about is probably more manipulation than coercion.
I think it's hard, too, especially if you got a single person, because they'll put the ball off and back in your court. They'll sit there and go, well, what would you do if you were in my position?
Right. And that's a question I often get when doing ethics consults. Well, what would you do if it were your mother? I mean, and the standard answer in the textbook is, well, it's not my mother, it's your mother, and you should decide based on her values. And I go there, but I'm a little more relaxed and say, well, I know my mother, and I know that she would choose this because these are her values. But I don't know your mother, and so it's important to understand what her values are. So I'm willing to go a little ways on that path, but to not commit and say, but if they ask me, what would you do if you were going to be in the study? I mean, I would be willing to give an answer. But from the PI, there could certainly be some bias there.
It's harder with the kid. Yeah. If it's your kid, what would you do?
Right.
You know, that's the toughest one. If I'm not in a study teasing, good at all, but you know, if you're studying, you got to kind of, I at least try to say, well, you know, kind of walk the fence on the questions.
Yep.
To me, the line between persuasion and manipulation is really fine. Mm-hmm. And I think it gets really blurry. And I think there are some populations that might be more swayed by the use of flattery. I mean, you know, you have a unique contribution to make here, and by the use of authority, you know,
yep,
emphasizing sources and degrees and whatever, and to evaluate what populations may be more vulnerable to that. I think it's a really blurry.
Certainly a possibility, and it requires intellectual honesty on the part of the.
Well, we
PI.
Are
exactly.
You know,
conflict
mean,
of interest.
Yes,
that's on our list.
Absolutely. And that way, I do. I mean, I agree with what you were saying about having somebody that's neutral and that's guy actually. Yeah,
I actually had a personal experience with LASIK surgery, and my eye doctor, he was a friend, and we were talking about it, and he was telling me to hold off for a while. And then finally, I understood that he had his wife.
Uh-huh.
And I say, well, I think I'm ready.
That's your barometer.
Yeah. One of the curious things, because I hadn't heard this term before, we've always used a study doctor as opposed to doctor physician.
Uh-huh.
But you've brought up this term investigator. And that, to me, as a non-physician, is a much more non-loaded term. Even a study doctor has its
right
still areas.
Because I mean, I don't think that patients, potential subjects, really understand what a clinical study is. They may think, well, we're going to try this and see if it works. Well, yeah, but it's research. It's an experiment. So I really try to steer clear of the term clinical study and study doctor. I mean, I think that's better than physician, but still I think it's being less than forthright.
We have an expectation that from the IRB that anyone doing the consent has education to be able to perform the consent appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
To assume that the physician is in a better position than someone else may be a mistake, except we have a system that has to look at some of these assumptions and carry them on. I think we need is one thought